Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the hardest thing you have ever done? We all face challenges in life, some of our own choosing, others thrown in our path by fate. For the past 3 decades, Marshall Ulrich has combined the two. He took up long-distance running to take control of his soaring blood pressure, a problem that began when his first wife was diagnosed with an aggressive form of breast cancer. For the 30 years since then, running has been both a refuge from his problems and a source of them at times, as he struggled to balance his drive to complete ever more difficult physical challenges with his obligations as a husband and father. He has run hundreds of marathons and ultramarathons, climbed the highest peaks in 7 continents, yes, including Mount Everest, and run back and forth multiple times across Death Valley completely alone. 2 years ago, at the age of 57, Ulrich ran more than 3,000 miles from San Francisco to New York in just 52 days, an experience that took an incredible toll on his body and somewhat of a toll on his relationships, but also rewarded him with new insights into himself and the people he loves most. Marshall Ulrich is a trainer, speaker, guide, and author of the new book, Running on Empty, an ultramarathoner's story of love, loss, and a record-setting run across America. Marshall, welcome to Think.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So I want to talk about this. You first took up running on the advice of your doctor, and you found that it was good for calming your mind as well as for lowering your blood pressure.
Yeah, and that's true. My blood pressure had gone up. It had soared to about 140 over 90, 95, and it was just pretty much out of control. And the doc said, you know, you either start running, start exercising, or I'll put you on medication. And, of course, I chose to do the running aspect of it, and that seemed to calm my nerves just a bit, and it brought my blood pressure down. And it's gone down gradually since then, and, you know, it's been over 25 years.
And did it surprise you to realize how quickly your body is perfectly suited to running long distances?
It seems to be, and I think as far as just being sturdy and biomechanically blessed, I think some of it has to do with genes, and then, of course, watching what I eat and paying attention to my training and giving myself, my body, a rest when it needs it, so just listening to my body. I think it all is sort of wrapped up in the package, and that helps me do the distances that I do.
But I have to tell you, Marshall, reading the book, which is really an amazing story, I'm struck with the impression that it's your mind that is the thing that makes it possible for you to do all this.
Well, you know, and I think that's true. I have a good friend who trained me, who ran across the Sahara Desert, Ray Zahab, and what he likes to say is that running ultramarathons is 90% mental, and the other 10% is all in your head. So I think there's a lot of that that is very true. Now, when I was younger, I used to just sort of bowl myself through it, but as I've gotten older, I've discovered that physically I'm not able to do some of the things that I used to be able to do, and so the mental becomes more and more important and comes into play much more.
People might assume, listening to your story, that you were like this superhuman and you never have an ache or a pain. But in fact, it sounds like you're never without pain. What is your relationship to that physical discomfort?
Well, training for this extreme run across the United States, and even before that, I've been blessed where I haven't been injured that terribly much. Now, during the run itself, I did get some injuries, and I think it's because I, of course, was pushing the limits, having to run 70 miles per day for the first 6 days, trying to break a record that was set by a 28-year-old, and here I am, 57 years old. So I'm blessed not having a lot of injuries, but during the run, I had a plantar fasciitis and then also a tear in the same foot, lateral tear in the tendon on the outside of the foot, and the foot swelled and it became problematic, but that didn't stop me for the most part, just it slowed me down a couple of days, but I it was just mind over matter. So I've been blessed in that respect, and I think, you know, there are things that we can overcome now. If it would have been a fracture or something like that, I would have had a hard time finishing, so I just pay attention to what's going on with my body more than anything.
You had considered doing a run like this earlier in your career, and then you had some family obligations that made that impossible. Did you have a sense when you did this 2 years ago, in terms of your age, although you're incredibly fit, did you think, well, maybe it's now or never?
Yes, I absolutely did. I had wanted to do it in 1992 when there was a transcontinental race, and I had to pay attention, of course, to raising my family and my business. Couldn't take the time off. So I thought to myself, okay, the sponsorship fell in line. There was even a documentary that was produced out of this called Running America. And so I thought to myself, you know, this is it. It's now or never, because if I get to be maybe 58 or 60 years old, I'll be able to do it. But I'm not going to be able to try and go after any records. And I thought it was, I entertained myself thinking that, you know, I could go after that record that was set by a 28-year-old man. And in the back of my mind, I thought, boy, that's going to be a push, and it's probably not possible. But, you know, I guess the message is how do you know unless you try? And I did not want age to be a big factor. So that was my thinking.
And your wife, who turns out to have been this amazing source of support for you while you were on this run, tried for months to talk you out of it.
She did, and she was dead set against it. And it wasn't until 2 or 3 weeks before I left that you know, she knew that I would have. I told her I couldn't do it without her, mm-hmm. and I firmly believe. I know now I couldn't have done it without her, but I knew then that there wasn't a good chance of me finishing if I didn't have her on board. And so she acquiesced and said, you know, finally, yes, about 3 weeks before we started, she says, I'll support you in this. So it was a total act of love for her. Excuse me.
And
I got just a little bit of a cold. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay. I was going to say the role she takes on is extraordinary, because essentially what happens is you end up playing good cop, bad cop. Like, you get to be like pretty nice to the team all the time. And when you have a real problem, she's the one who goes in there and kind of deals with it so that you can focus on just moving your body forward in space.
Right. That's very true. And, you know, that's the other gift that she has. She knew enough not to tell me or divulge those things that were happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they finally did come to a head, and I did have to take care of some of them. But she was so good about concealing that sort of thing and putting on, you know, that smiling face all the time that she knew that she would have to have or display to me so I could finish the task at hand. I mean, it was just an extreme act of love. You know, what she told me afterwards is there were times she wanted to scream at me at the top of her lungs to stop, stop, stop. But she knew that I had, you know, things that I had to work out on the road. And, you know, essentially as the miles fell under my feet, I did come to a point where I came to peace with a lot of the things that I've been wrestling with all of my life.
Yeah, it was really interesting, because right before you started this run, you had had right in a row 4 incredibly painful losses that you hadn't even had time to grieve yet.
Yes, that's really true. One was called it was Ted Corbett, who is called the father of ultra running. He's one of them that he was instrumental in kicking off the New York Marathon way back in the 50s and 60s. So that was one person. He was 88 years old when he passed away, and he was out there, you know, rooting me on through all of my training before and coaching me. So he was one person who passed away about 9 months before. Then there was my father, who passed away about 4 months before I set out. And then my wife's father passed away. And then a dear friend who I had not known that long, but he seemed to be like the mirror image of me when I was, you know, he was me 20 years earlier.
Hmm.
And so, you know, he was just this wonderful person. He put together a little film footage for me, and we just got to be great friends after he put that film together. About 2 days later, he was hit on a head-on collision and, you know, died instantly. So I was grieving all of that, and, you know, it was just a way for me to get out on the road, and I felt compelled. That seemed to be my familiarity with dealing with things. Instead of turning to my loved ones, I'd go out and hammer it out on the road. So during the run, I found that I could turn to my wife and I could open my heart. And she was, of course, you know, very accepting of all that. And in fact, she tried to lead me to that early on, but I was just so stubborn, I guess. I just needed to learn how to love again, and she taught me that.
My guest is Marshall Ulrich. He's an ultramarathoner, trainer, speaker, and guide. His new book is called Running on Empty, an ultramarathoner's story of love, loss, and a record-setting run across America. We'll resume our conversation with Marshall in a couple of minutes and invite you now to call in and join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also interact via email to think@kera.org. Do you want to take a couple of minutes now to remind you that we are raising money to keep KERA strong and healthy to enable us to continue serving you every day? We would love for you to make a contribution now at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931. If you want to make a contribution at or above the $120 level, we have copies of Running on Empty, Marshall Ulrich's book. If you are a runner, particularly a distance runner, I think you will absolutely relate to a lot in this book. But honestly, I'm not a distance runner, and there's just a lot of human story here that is really interesting to anybody who has to deal with adversity or sort of overcome hardship in one's own life. It's a really interesting piece of writing. We do have it available as a thank you at the $120 level. And Jeff Whittington is back in the studio now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. I'm so excited about this interview. I love these kinds of stories. I mean,
Nicole's going to wish that you hadn't heard any of this.
Nicole's my wife, everyone. But Marshall is the kind of he's the kind of storyteller and athlete that just is so inspiring. And we're really excited to be able to bring you this conversation today during our membership campaign. And I'm looking forward to the next segment. And if you are looking forward to the next segment, don't worry. It's going to start in about 4 minutes, so you have plenty of time to call 888-694-6931. You have plenty of time to go online right now to kera.org and make a contribution. I want to thank those of you who have contributed $35 or $250 or $500 or $1,000 or more. Every single donation adds up. It's so important that you make your contribution right now. Please call or go online and do it right now.
You know, sometimes when we talk about why we're raising money, we talk about the importance of paying our bills, you know, for programming, for lights, for staff, for microphones, for everything. But the truth is, when you make a contribution, you're paying your bill. You're paying your share of making this sort of programming available. All of us who listen are part of the audience that benefits from this. And I consider myself a listener even more sometimes than I consider myself a producer of programming. All of us who listen help to incur these expenses, and those of us who recognize the value of them and toss a little bit of money back into the process help to make sure that we're able to continue this programming that you care about. We have programming produced locally. We have award-winning news reports from our local staff. We also have great shows coming to you from around the world because of your contributions.
You know, these drives do seem sometimes, I'll make a cheesy metaphor, like a never-ending ultramarathon.
Like an ultramarathon.
Yeah, they
the
really
Leadville
do.
100.
They really do. But, you know, your contributions, your calls to 888-694-6931, your online contributions at kera.org, that's what leads to the success of this radio station. We are thrilled to be able to bring you these kinds of conversations like the one that Chris is having right now with Marshall Ulrich, and we're going to get right back to that. But please take a moment right now to make your contribution.
You can do that by going online to kera.org, where you can check out thank you gifts, including copies of Running on Empty. You can also make a telephone call to 1-888-694-6931. We'll be back in just a minute with Marshall Ulrich.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is competitive runner Marshall Ulrich. He's also a trainer, speaker, and guide, and author of the new book Running on Empty, an ultramarathoner's story of love, loss, and a record-setting run across America. You can join the conversation by calling in. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Marshall, you were talking about on this run across America, sort of learning for the first time to fully open yourself up emotionally to your wife, Heather. You are very candid throughout the book in ways that I think a lot of people who've written similar books have not been able to be, about the fact that in some ways your obsession with running has been a sort of a double-edged sword in your life. It's been good for you to process certain things, but it's also taken you away from the people and the things that you cared about.
Yeah, it really has, and I think you hit the nail on the head. There's good and bad with everything, and my success with running was, you know, I was dedicated to it, but I was less dedicated to my family and my wife than I should have been. That's not to say that I completely failed, but I tried to become, you know, as honest as possible and down to earth, and I wanted to relate to everybody. One of the compliments that I get about the book, and the demographic for the book, by the way, is 40 to 60-year-old women. That's one of the demographics who don't even run. So I have a hard time getting them to read the book, but once they've read the book, they say, this book is great, and not only that, it's, you know, I don't think it's even about running. And they're really right, even though, you know, so much of it is about the run. Excuse me. But so much of it is just about life and about loving, and it's a love story. It's multi-layered. So I thought to myself, once I got some of those comments, it's like, bingo, that's my target market. I wanted to transcend just a typical running book, and I think I've done it with Running on Empty.
And then there's an amazing scene where you're on your transcontinental run, and your kids, all who are now adults and doing quite well, showed up to support you.
Yes, it's really true. So it was my children, and that was the first time they had all been together to see me come out and run, and I felt like they had an understanding of what I was doing. They came out in Colorado and then later to the finish, and I got to communicate with them and just observe them sort of from the outside interacting together in a way that was very natural. And in addition to that, my brother, who I've had a troubled relationship with, for the first time he came out and saw me run in Colorado, as well as my mother and one of my aunts. And so it was like a big reunion, and my heart just absolutely soared when that happened, because they really had not acknowledged what I was doing for all of these years, and they knew that I was troubled, I'm sure. But for the first time, they realized that it was important to me, and it became important to them too, and it just sort of really turned things around.
Okay, so you started out, and your initial goal was to do 70 miles a day, and you eventually cut that back to about 60 miles a day, which is just unbelievable. I mean, that would be a lot, you know, on a bicycle for most people. Talk about how you trained in the months leading up to setting off from San Francisco.
I started, well, of course, I'd been training with ultra marathons and adventure races as well as mountaineering for years and years before, so I had a good base of, you know, 25 years of running marathons, ultra marathons, things like that. So that all factored in. But then what I did is I went in about a year before and started with 60 miles per week, and then I bumped it up to 80, and then progressively mixed in you know, things for core strengthening, like pulling a tire for sometimes up to 18 miles uphills, and weightlifting, and then, of course, just running mostly on pavement, because I do a lot of trail running and enjoy that so much more, but you have to go back to exactly what you're going to be doing, and that would be running on asphalt. So I had to shift my focus to asphalt running, bumping it up to sometimes 210 miles per week, because, you know, naturally I would have to do that in order to run the 400-plus miles per week. And one of the chapters, incidentally, is called the 400-mile work week, which is sort of the nuts and bolts of, you know, how I did it and what it looked like.
What is your, you know, runners are supposed to replace their shoes every 300 to 500 miles. What kind of build do you have at the end of the year for running shoes?
You know, I don't, unfortunately.
Are you sponsored?
I've got great sponsorship. And normally I just go through maybe 6 or 8 shoes per year. During the run itself, I went through 32 pair of shoes, tossing them basically at about 150 miles per shoe. And it wasn't that they were worn out. It's just that they would break down just slightly, and I needed to keep my form and my biomechanics intact, and so I would change them out often.
And you actually had to consume, to keep going at this pace, you had to consume about 9,000 calories a day. Is this right?
Right.
How do you find the time to eat all that?
Well, what that consisted of is I'd eat breakfast in the morning, and then I'd get out the door, and my crew would stop about every mile and give me a handful of food, and I essentially did not drink any water at all. It was all like soda. It was all juices. It was things with calories. So every mile, I basically would eat, and so I had 60 courses during the day, and at the end of the day, I was so well fed that, you know, I could just go to sleep and not worry about having to eat until the next morning. The interesting thing is that I was so well taken care of by my crew, and I attribute my success, you know, entirely to my crew and my wife, was the fact that I only lost 4 pounds between San Francisco and New York. So I, you know, they were doing something right.
Yeah, that's amazing. Of course, eating 9,000 calories a day and losing 4 pounds is a dream for many Americans who are not in your sort of shape. Talk about this, because you are so complimentary of your crew. It sounds like, well, that's an easy job. You just sit in the van and go forward an hour and leapfrog, or a mile rather. But this was a really stressful gig for the people who helped you out.
It was. What they were doing was they were doing it in two shifts. I'd be running 17 to 18 hours per day. So there would be a shift of somebody, two people who would be on for, say, 8 hours, and then somebody would relieve them after 8 or 9 hours. Now, when we were short on crew, what would happen is they would have to pull double shifts. So they were on the road sometimes between 17 and 18 hours, and there were a couple of days when I was doing those 70-mile days early on that I went from, say, doing that mileage in 14 hours to 22 hours. So, you know, here all of a sudden, you know, they're doing 22-hour days, so in stopping every mile, mind you. So I guess the joke was for them, they'd say, well, we're seeing America 1 mile at a time, and they meant that literally. It was just unbelievable what they did.
What sort of shape were you in at the end of a day of going 60 or 70 miles?
Well, what I'll do is I'll just break it down and tell you what the protocol was for my running. So I'd get up in the morning, and I would refuse to go out in the dark. So as soon as there was first light, I would get out the door, I'd run a marathon. And I would run the marathon pretty slow, and I'll explain that to you why I did that initially. I would run until 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, once again, very slowly, that first marathon. Then I'd sleep for about 30 to 45 minutes, take a little nap. Then I'd get out the door, and I'd run another 35 miles or so. So then when I'd hit 40 miles, I'd have a little dinner, a little bit bigger portion of food. And then at 50 miles, I always had to have something to look forward to, and it was just a little incremental, the little things that really meant a lot. So 50 miles on the day would be happy hour. They'd bring out popcorn and O'Doul's beer, and it was like, woohoo, you know, we're having happy hour. And it was something to look forward to. I loved it. So then I'd run to 60 miles, and that would usually put me anywhere from midnight sometimes to 2 or 3 in the morning. And then I'd get up the next day and do it all over again. Now, circling back, the reason that I was running that marathon so slow is because I'd be sleeping 4 hours and my body was recovering then. But then I would use that first marathon every day as a recovery.
So you were recovering while running a marathon.
Yes.
Sleep deprivation was an issue for you, though.
It wasn't an issue for me early on. I was having nightmares because my body, I think the way it interpreted what I was doing to it was killing it. And in fact, you know, I was. So I'd have these horrible nightmares about being incarcerated or being in front of a firing squad or something like that. And then once my body settled into it, you know, it was a little bit better. And once I started sleeping a minimum of 4 hours per night, then I was okay. And I found that if I dipped below that to 3 hours and, say, did 65 miles or 70 miles, you know, that it was just diminishing returns, and I knew that I couldn't finish.
What do you think about when you're running?
Well, there's lots of things I think about. You know, of course, Heather, my wife, you know, I knew that she would be somewhere along the course, and so I'd look forward to that. I'd think about my kids. I'd think about life in general. I'd think about those men who were such an inspiration to me and who had passed on. And then there were times when I would just drown the noise out in my head, you know, that talk that is saying, you know, just stop, stop, stop.
Mm-hmm.
I'd listen to music, and especially late at night, I would play certain songs over again and again and again. And I turned the volume up, so literally it was like white noise, and it allowed me to take the focus off of that voice in my head that was telling me to stop.
Yeah, you write as you have a sort of Ten Commandments, and at the number one slot is quitting is not an option. Is that just wired into you, or is it something that you've built up over the years?
I've built it up over the years, and I think a lot of it has to do with a work ethic, and I talk about this also growing up on a farm where we used to go out and sled hay and stack bales, and just quitting, we had to get the job done, and so it was sort of, you know, part of who I was as I grew up, and a part of a work ethic. So, I think that's where it comes from, and the focus comes from that. Now, having said that, you know, that's the first thing in the Ten Commandments, and the reason I put it number one is that we all have those thoughts. There were a dozen times a day that I thought about quitting, but, you know, we don't have to, it's not that we don't pay attention to it, but we just have to kind of disregard that and put it in proper perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the reason it's there is to remind yourself through the other nine commandments that it's there, and that's kind of the goal. That's the carrot that's leading you on.
Marshall Ulrich is my guest. He's an ultramarathoner, trainer, speaker, and guide. His new book is called Running on Empty, an ultramarathoner's story of love, loss, and a record-setting run across America. We'll take another brief break from our discussion with Marshall. And if you'd like to join us or ask a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. If you are interested in supporting KERA this afternoon at or above the $120 level, and you want to read Running on Empty, have we got a deal for you? It is available as a thank you gift at the $120 level. You can reserve your copy by going online to kera.org, or you can call 1-888-694-6931. When you do so, you will also be enrolled in this drawing for an iPad 2, which will take place every day for the next 5 or 6 days. But most of all, you will be supporting your public radio station.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, Jeff.
This book is it's so perfect for us, because not only does it have a nice long subtitle after the colon, but it has another subtitle too, which
the double subtitle.
It's a double subtitle book.
Public radio gold.
It says 3,063 miles, 52 days, 57 years old. I mean, this is an incredible story, and I'm really excited that we're able to have Marshall is our guest today on the phone this hour. I personally love true sports triumph stories, and I know that a lot of you do too. And this kind of story is perfect for the show, because we're really getting a chance for you to talk to our guest and to get really deeply into, you know, the things he's thinking about, his process, how he approaches this kind of challenge. And you know, that's what's so great about this show, and that's what's so great about public radio in general, because, you know, I'm sure that Marshall's done a lot of interviews, and I'm sure that some of them have been 2 or 3 minutes long. And that has its place. It certainly does. And those kinds of broadcasters are under different pressures than we are. You know, they're not on the air asking you to send money to the station, for one thing. But they also don't have the luxury to be able to invest the time and the space to hearing someone's story. And that's what you get when you tune in to public radio, and that's especially what you get on this show and on KERA, is you get time, space, depth, and you get involved, essentially. You get drawn in to these kinds of conversations. What's that worth to you? Decide that it's worth something, please, and call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org and make a contribution.
We know that the reason that you listen is because you recognize that KERA is different from other radio stations in North Texas, and you've decided this is the way you want your content presented to you. Maybe not 24 hours a day, maybe you sample around, but maybe you come in for this show, or maybe you're always here for All Things Considered, or maybe you never miss the weekend programming. You must love the content to be with us, as we always say, during the fundraising campaign. And I would say this, you know, we've already sort of, the fair weather listeners who don't want to listen when we're raising money are already out of here. So everyone we're speaking to is someone who is a lover of public radio and a supporter or potential supporter of the station. If you've never done it before, we would ask that you try it for the first time and see how great it feels to know that you're part of the team that makes KERA. You can do this online at kera.org, or you can call 1-888-694-6931.
Over 60% of the revenue that the station requires, the dollars that the station needs to spend, that it spends, but the dollars it needs to stay financially responsible and healthy comes directly from you. Our funding model, there are various percentages from various groups, and 89% is from you. That's about 61%. And the rest of it is foundations, corporations right here in the North Texas area who support KERA, who support the model we have here. But by far, the lion's share of what it takes to run the station comes directly from your contributions when you call 888-694-6931 or make it online at kera.org. 61 cents of every dollar that is spent here at KERA comes directly from you. We don't want it to change. We actually, you know, we like that. That's part of the deal because it means that we don't have to make decisions about what to cover, how to approach a topic with anyone in mind besides you. We're just thinking about what will you, the listener to KERA, get out of this.
And the great thing is, if you are ready to make a contribution and you think, well, I'd like to give, you know, a significant amount, but I don't know, this is, I got to wait till I get paid or something, you can set up a sustaining membership. And what this does is break what would normally be an annual contribution into, you know, ongoing monthly contributions. And that's a great option for a lot of people. It's really easy. Once you have it set up, you can just sort of leave it until you want to change it. If you would like to change your sustaining membership plan, maybe kick a few more dollars in every month, of course, you can do that as well. You can go online to kera.org and make a contribution, or you can call us at 1-888-694-6931. At or above the $120 contribution level today, we do have copies of Running on Empty by Marshall Ulrich. We also still have copies of last hour's book, You Are What You Speak by Robert Lane Green. Whether you take a thank you gift or not, we would just love to hear from you at kera.org or 888-694-6931. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is ultramarathoner, trainer, speaker, guide, and author Marshall Ulrich. His new book is called Running on Empty, an ultramarathoner's story of love, loss, and a record-setting run across America. If you'd like to talk to Marshall, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. Marshall, I want to talk to you about this because you were incredibly gracious at the end to Charlie Engel, who started out fully as your partner in this and helped to obtain some sponsorships and was planning, as you were, to run from San Francisco to New York, ended up dropping out after 18 days. But can you talk a little bit about what happened there and sort of how that affected your progress throughout the 52 days of the run?
Well, that was one of the things that I feared when I initially set out is that, take for instance, Charlie would not make it, or, you know, I was even thinking, well, myself also. The agreement that we had with each other is that we would support each other throughout the run if one were to go down. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. So with Charlie, he started having some problems, tendonitis in the front of his legs, and it got to be pretty much debilitating, and he was put out in Utah after about 800 miles into the run. So after that, I was pretty much alone. He continued on with me pretty much the rest of the way, but being out there by myself, it was a whole nother dimension. It was another thing when there was the presence of mind that he was either in front of me or behind me, mm-hmm. and so exponentially it just made it tougher because it made that feeling of loneliness just almost overwhelming.
How often along the way did you sort of run past people who would be cheering you on or holding up signs or that sort of thing?
It really wasn't that often. It seemed like it was every, say, 100 miles or 200 miles. Sometimes it was spaced so far between that I couldn't even think about the last time that I had seen it. You know, it could be a span of 800 miles from Nevada all the way into Colorado.
What was continue.
I'm sorry?
What was the worst kind of weather on this particular run?
Well, I think it was, you know, there was some of the altitude, and with the altitude comes inclement weather, so there's a little bit of snow that we broached when we went up over the Rocky Mountains. But mostly in Nebraska and Pennsylvania, Ohio, there were days of 3 or 4 days of rain, and then Pennsylvania, of course, rain and snow, and it didn't matter what was going on outside. We just had to layer up and put on some waterproof clothing, and, you know, it just didn't deter what we did at all.
And there was a point at which you realized you hadn't brought enough socks along to change as frequently as you needed to, and that you were sending people out in these little tiny towns that you were running through trying to find the right footwear.
Right. And, you know, there were a couple of socks. There was in Gingy and Balega socks that I was running, and those were my favorites. And when we ran low on them, and I was wearing these socks out, say, every 4 to 5 days, so it became a problem. And so we were continually sourcing out things that would work along the way. So it was kind of like thinking fast on your feet.
We have an email here from Vicky who wants to know what you think about running in sock shoes or running barefoot.
I think the barefoot running, that's been a big thing the last, say, year or so. And I think it's fine when you use it for training. I think it works perfectly to help strengthen, you know, some of the soft tissue. And I think it puts less strain on your knees. However, I think it should be done sparingly, because what you wind up doing is, with that form of running, it forces you to run on your forefoot just a little bit more, and then you'll be trading injuries. It'll go from the knees to, it puts stress on your plantar fasciitis, it puts stress on your Achilles tendon and also your calves. So you have to just be careful and keep a balance, and if you start becoming injured, you know, I would try something different. But I'm an advocate of a minimalistic shoe, but, you know, I run in shoes just because I'm running trails most of the time.
Mm-hmm. There were times when your feet were so swollen that you actually had to cut open the toes of your shoes.
Right, and the laces, and that was primarily the right-hand foot because of the plantar fasciitis and then the torn tendon. And there's a picture in Running on Empty where I have one foot right next to the other, and it's obvious that the foot is swollen about 2 or 3 sizes bigger than the other one. So
it's like there's no arch at all.
Yeah, it looks like there's no arch. That's correct. So, and that picture was incidentally taken about 3 weeks after I finished the run, so it was even a little bit larger when I was out there running. So it was just taking a little bit of ibuprofen and icing it, and that was the best that we could do.
This question from Jeff, who is calling from our control room and is a producer of the show but also a runner. What kind of shoes did you wear?
I used primarily Perlizumis. They're one of my sponsor, and you know, people ask me a lot about shoes, and I recommend them just because they work for me. I think what a person has to do is, if they're interested in buying a pair of shoes, they need to go into a running store and you know, get fitted properly. And I think what works for them is the best. And I would emphasize that if they have some biomechanical type problems, that they should look for support where they need it. Say if they pronate and roll in, then they should look for some support there. But, you know, I think a person needs to just get the shoe that works for them.
So, Marshall, you dreamed about doing this for the longest time. You trained for it. You finally completed the run. Did it feel, when you summited the steps of New York City Hall to end your run, did it feel the way you expected it would?
It did feel very much like I expected it. Take, for instance, when I summited Mount Everest, there was a deep sense of gratitude. Mm-hmm. The same thing, a wave of that came over me when I finished at City Hall. A wave of gratitude, a closeness, that connection with my children, with Heather, and that was the difference, because I did it totally alone on Everest, but here I had my family with me. So that was the big difference, and it made it also more sparkling in my array of things that I finished, so it was a wonderful feeling.
It sounds like in the past, and forgive me because I'm assuming here, that you would have one of these amazing accomplishments, and we didn't even go into the list of all the things that you've done over your career, but then you were always sort of soon after thinking about the next thing. Was this a big enough achievement to sort of fill that hole for you?
It was, in that I will, you know, I'll never do anything like that again. What I like to say is that, you know, running across America every day was like summit day out on Mount Everest. It was that difficult. So I do not want to go back to that space and go backwards in time. I've tested my body. I know what it's all about. Now, that's not to say that I don't have goals. I still do mountain climbing. This summer, in fact, I'll be going up the Eiger and the Matterhorn. But still, they're safer routes. There's not as much exposure to endurance, and I'm not concerned with speed and things like that. So, you know, it's a part of who I am, what I do. But certainly, I don't want to jeopardize my relationship with my wife and my children at this point. So it has to be with their approval, whereas before, you know, it was kind of my own decision.
What have you learned about the right way to train other people to do really challenging things?
You know, I think more than anything is that you really have to pay attention to, take for instance with running, your mileage. You have to be able to get the mileage in. Plus, what I've learned is that core training is very, very important, you know, strengthening the stomach and even the upper body. And then the third thing is that it's essential, and I didn't used to think this. I used to run every day, but I think it's essential to at least take a rest day off and even two off. You know, of those 200 miles I would be doing per week when I was training for this, I'd take a rest day off, and it was so beneficial, not only physically but mentally.
Is it hard for you to rest?
No, it isn't. In fact, throughout my running career, there was a couple of months, usually November and December, where I would just be tired of running, and I wouldn't run a stitch, and I still do it to this day, with the exception of running across the United States, because I had to focus for a long period of time and keep that mileage up.
Marshall Ulrich's new book is called Running on Empty, an ultramarathoner's story of love, loss, and a record-setting run across America. Marshall, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Well, thank you very much, and I think you're doing good work with public radio. It's just fantastic, and I love listening to it. So thank you for having me on.
Sure, appreciate that. Thanks. Thanks to all of you who have been listening this hour. What an amazing story. What an inspirational story. And the great thing, as Marshall alluded to earlier when we were talking, is that it's the sort of story that can motivate you to do a lot of different things. It's not strictly speaking for runners. I think it has things to offer anyone who might just have a difficult task ahead and needs to sort of get in the right mind frame for that. If you're interested in reading the book, we do have copies available as a thank you gift at or above the $120 contribution level. Those can be yours when you go online to kera.org to make your contribution. And you can also do this over the phone if that's easier for you. You just call 1-888-694-6931. We are, of course, in our spring membership campaign. Our overall goal is $625,000. That's the money that the folks who keep track of the money here at the station have said we need in order to function properly, to stay in the black, to continue serving you all the programming that you count on, that you really like. We are not trying to make a big profit here. In fact, we're a not-for-profit organization. Your contribution is tax-deductible. What you're really paying for here is a community service that you enjoy and also is available to your friends and your family and your neighbors. Jeff Whittington is back. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. I've got quite a few people to thank. Michael Porter in Arlington supported the station. Samuel Murphy in Carrollton, Kay Rutherford in Alito, Paula Mascarenas in Irving, Jeanette Aparico in Dallas, Mr. Bashkar Sarkar in Flower Mound, Donna Crittenden in Fort Worth, Mr. Tao Ming Trong in Hillsboro. We also heard from Sarah Wilgus in Celeste, Dan Acree in Denison, Betsy Elam in Fort Worth, and Corbett Ray in Dallas. People all over North Texas are supporting the station today. Thank you so much to each and every one of you. You can join these fine folks Now that the show's over, and sadly, we won't have any more conversation with Marshall, but we have this opportunity now for you to call 888-694-6931 or contribute at kera.org.
Your support of the station is really what it's the lifeblood. I mean, you could almost look at the money that comes in from other sources as sort of the icing on the cake, but you are more than half of the support. You're 61%. And you'd be surprised, you know, if people who have supported us in the past somehow are not able to do so this year. We really feel that. So if you have never supported KERA in the past and have thought, well, I don't know, maybe this is a great year to do it. Maybe you do it in the place of someone who can't continue supporting the station. But honestly, it's able to be so affordable, particularly with the sustaining membership plan, that just about everybody who listens, I think, can find a way to support KERA. The real challenge is not so much finding the money, it's finding a way to convince you that that it's really worthwhile to do.
888-694-6931. It is worthwhile. If you listen to Think, if you listen to KERA regularly, you know it. You know what you're getting. You know what you're helping to pay for. Go online to kera.org. Check out the thank you gifts. We do have copies of Running on Empty, an ultramarathoner's story of love, loss, and a record-setting run across America by Marshall Ulrich, who is our guest this hour. That's available when you join the station at the $120 membership level or above. So do your part right now. That's just $10 a month if you become a sustaining member with a $10 a month contribution. That's probably something that many of you can afford. And you know what? Your $120 annual contribution goes a long way here at KERA.
You can hear exactly what it's paying for whenever you turn on the radio. Thank you so much, Deborah Shannon in Dallas, Yo-Jung Kim in Dallas, Matt and Ginny Vietti, Jason and Jennifer Huntsberry, and Catherine Irwin in Carrollton. Also, Christine Dolligan in Dallas, or maybe it's Dollahan in Dallas, and Lisa Miner in Longview. Thanks to all of you for calling in, for going online. The money adds up after a while, and whether your contribution feels very large to you or it feels modest, it certainly is necessary to us.
You're listening to 90.1 KERA Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton. Always online, streaming at kera.org. You can also find podcasts of this show and of the Anything Show. You can find news stories. You can download those as well at kera.org. All that's available absolutely free of charge to you. All you have to do is go there, and there's so much information. There's so much material and so much content available for you at kera.org. There's also artandseek.org, which is brought to you by KERA and also is helped funded by your contributions right here to KERA. So it's really amazing what you get, and you'd only have to give back a little. And you know what? You don't even have to do that. We just hope that you will give back something during this membership campaign.
The place to go online is kera.org, where you can call 1-888-694-6931. You know, the goals that we talk about, you'll notice that sometimes they're different. You know, they've been higher in the past. They've been lower in the past. This time it's $625,000. Those are not arbitrarily set. In fact, the reason they change is because the folks here who make sure that there is enough money to fund all the projects that we want to take undertake to serve you, they will look at how much money it takes, and then we will come to you as honestly as we can. You know, it might be adjusted according to if a certain amount of underwriting were to change or something. But the majority of the support has come from listeners like you for maybe forever, but certainly I've worked here for 10 years, and it's certainly that long.
And, you know, it's really smart folks who try very hard to stretch every dollar as far as possible. It's not a big, you know, room-sized computer with a stack of punch cards down in the basement that we feed the punch cards in. And it goes do-do-do-do-do-do, and then the punch card comes out and it says, this time you will raise $625,000. No, it's actually a little bit more, it's a little bit more intuitive than that. And it's we try to use your contributions as intelligently, as wisely, and as, of course, as frugally as possible here to bring you the absolute best programming, I think, that you find on any radio station. And you probably listen. We know that many of you listen to other radio stations and you sample, but you go and listen to the different music station. Maybe you listen to our sister station, KXT, a little bit. But you come back to KERA because you don't find what you get here anywhere else. It's not available anywhere else in North Texas. That's why you listen, and that's why we think you should support it online at kera.org or on the phone at 1-888-694-6931.
Our expenses are your expenses. The reason we have them is because we're serving you, and that's not to sort of make you feel bad about this. It's just to appeal to your pragmatic and honest sense of you know, wanting to do something to make sure that you take part. The telephone number to call to become a member is 1-888-694-6931, or you can go online to kera.org. We do have a few tickets left for Cirque du Soleil, also the Fort Worth Opera's The Mikado or Il Trovatore. You can call that number for details and find out how to get your tickets while also supporting the station. We would love to hear from you now at kera.org. Thank you so much for your support.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.